namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa buddhang dhammang sanghang kunutarang upacchayang namassami So good morning, everyone, and I have to ask you to bear with my voice. I have a few problems with a sore throat and a cough. So I'm going to begin this morning by offering a few reflections on teachings of the Buddha and a way of practice, and following that we'll have a guided meditation, and then from 11 through to 12 there'll be an opportunity to ask questions and to talk about issues which might not get covered during the talk and are of particular interest to you. So that'll be the morning session. So I'd like just to begin with this observation about the fundamental characteristic of life, which is change. So this isn't a Buddhist teaching as such, but as human beings, we are living in a world of change, and we ourselves, every aspect of our body and mind is subject to change. So we are confronted with a challenge. How do we live in a world of change? What's the best way of dealing with change? Now, if we look through history, then we can see that one common strategy or one trend is to fight against change. This is like what we call the conservative point of view. And people with this particular worldview tend to talk about how everything in the past was so much better than it is today. Everything today is going to the dogs. All the values that we held as in my time, no one seems to respect anymore. And the idea is that change is oppressing us. It's frightening. It's undermining everything that we hold dear. So the conservative viewpoint is to try to find certain things to hold on to that don't change. So you deal with change by trying to find things that don't change and hold on to them tightly. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why the outcome of the movement towards globalization the past 20 years or so has not conform to the expectations, instead of a growing openness to the world around us. People have been able to use modern technology and communications as a way of creating very inward-looking communities of like-minded people. And so over the past years, we've seen a growth of prejudice and a growth of this us and them kind of distinctions. We are right, everyone else is wrong. And the idea that it's by holding on to our group or our beliefs that we protect ourselves from change. Now, the opposite to that, of course, is the those who embrace change. It's the modern world. Look at everything from the past as outdated and past a sell-by date. Now is the time to move forward. These people find change, any kind of change, is exhilarating and exciting. And feel that this is what makes life worth living. And so this idea of change for change's sake, and that if something changes from the old, then basically it's a good thing overall. So these are, I would say, almost knee-jerk reactions to change, this obsession with the new or fetishization of the old. Now, when we look at Buddhism, then we find change is not considered to be an enemy of the religion at all. And in fact, as Buddhists, we are encouraged to understand change. So self-understanding, then that is, I think, taught in all religions and philosophies. But in Buddhism, this is allied with this idea that you want to understand yourself, you have to understand the nature of change. And the Buddha declared that change takes place in a way that is not random. The changes that take place are not acts of God. They're not predestined. They're not random. But they occur according to causes and conditions. So in Buddhism, we put a great deal of emphasis on understanding causality and seeing clearly how things appear. Once they've appeared, what sustains them, what feeds them, and how they pass away. And one very memorable sutta, the Buddha said that because people do not observe very closely how things arise in the world, how things arise in their mind, their personal world, then annihilationist teachings and cults, religions, develop. So the Buddha is saying that the belief that when you die, that's the end of everything, that belief is founded upon a lack of observation of the way things are. And he said that similarly, if you can see very clearly in real time, as it were, the passing away of phenomena according to causes and conditions, then belief in an eternal heaven and eternal hell realm will also dissolve. So again, the Buddha's making a very powerful and interesting statement that belief in eternal heaven, eternal hell, is based upon a lack of observation of the way things are. So the Buddha's teachings, the Dhamma, is called Ehipasika, which means it invites you to come and see, invites you to put it to the test, invites you to observe. So there's very little exhortation to take a leap of faith in Buddhism. But what we are encouraged to do is to look more closely at our life, look more closely at our body and our mind and the things happening around us, to learn, to study the way things are. But of course, when we, if we accept that as a as a path of practice, we are immediately confronted with the sobering truth that our mind is not really capable of conducting that kind of close observation, that the mind is very rarely present to its experience. Mind is caught up in thoughts and feelings and emotions, in desires and fears and expectations. And so to be able to see for ourselves the way things are, and to undermine the false beliefs and assumptions that we have accumulated in our life, we have to work with the instrument of observation itself, which is the mind, of course. So the training of the mind forms the centerpiece of Buddhist practice. Now, in many religious traditions, we have this idea of people who are like practicing or non-practicing members of a religion. But I would propose that in Buddhism, to say that someone is a non-practicing Buddhist is a contradiction in terms, because the faith that lies at the heart of Buddhist tradition is not a faith in dogmas, but is in faith in the human capacity for enlightenment. So when the Buddha was enlightened, became enlightened 2,500 and more years ago, prior to his enlightenment, he was a human being. He was a very special human being, we can say, but he was nevertheless a human being. But following his enlightenment, he became a Buddha. So Buddha is not a kind of special kind of human being. A Buddha is a category all of its own. There was an occasion where the Buddha was walking through the countryside before he began his teaching career, and he met someone on the path who was completely stunned by his radiance and was feeling this is someone very special. And his exclamation, you know, that was, "Are you a god?" And the Buddha said, "No, I'm not a god." And he said, "Are you a human being?" And the Buddha said, "No, I'm not a human being." And he refused to identify with any of these labels. The Buddha is someone who's transcended all of those conventional terms. He is a Buddha. But the point I would like to make here is that the enlightenment of the Buddha is something that took place over 2,500 years ago, and it's not something that any of us can prove, no matter how diligent we might be in our study and our meditation. So it is something that we take on trust. But the belief in the enlightenment of the Buddha is not an object of faith. It doesn't end there. It leads onwards. This is the nature of the Dhamma. Because the Buddha was enlightened, we can say, as a representative of the human race. He proved, in other words, that human beings can become enlightened. And the next stage of reflection that should follow from this is that if human beings have the capacity, have the potential for enlightenment, then so do I. So the belief in the Buddha's enlightenment is essentially a belief in our own capacity for enlightenment. So if one accepts that as an object of faith, that's not just, okay, I have the potential for enlightenment, and that's the end of it, that's just something I believe. But you are, I would say, duty-bound to put that belief to the test, to see whether or not it's actually true. So how do you do that? Well, the path of practice leading to enlightenment is abandonment of all that is unwholesome in the heart, the cultivation of the wholesome, and the purification of the heart. So we become Buddhists not by accepting certain dogmas, certain beliefs on trust, but they are the, you can say they are the place at which we begin to actualize ourselves as Buddhists through the effort to abandon the unwholesome in our hearts, to develop the wholesome, to purify our hearts. So if we're not putting any effort into that practice, then we can say, well, you know, in what sense are we truly Buddhist? So the teachings of the Buddha are an analysis of the way things are, and the remedy and the way of dealing with the way things are in the wisest possible way. Now the teachings of the Buddha are detailed in the Eightfold Path. Now that Eightfold Path is often telescoped into three areas. First is the training of body and speech. Second is the training of the heart or the mind. And the third is the training of wisdom. So I, I like to myself to refer to the Buddha's teachings as the most comprehensive and effective education system that the world has ever seen. So this is a very a different idea about religion and religious teachings. Religious teachings in Buddha Dhamma are considered tools to be made use of skillfully, and that we have to learn which tools should be used in which circumstances, and which tools need to be used together. Which tools are used in the beginning, which tools in the middle, which tools in the end. So there's these are looked upon as instruments that we should seek to make use of. So this threefold training, or the word in fact in Pali language is sikha, which is the very same word that we find in the Thai language, for instance, as siksa, which means education. So we're looking as our religious responsibilities, our religious duties, as comprised of education. Now this is sometimes the teachings of the Buddha are misrepresented as being very too selfish or too based upon the individual. But if you go to the primary source, go to the suttas, the discourses given by the Buddha over 45 years, you will find that that view just cannot stand up to the evidence there. And in fact, in referring to Buddha's teaching, he would usually, the Buddha himself, would refer to the Dhamma Vinaya. So Dhamma or Dharma is a word that many of you will be familiar with. Vinaya perhaps not so much, or at least you may have heard it in connection with the code of discipline which the Sangha adheres to. But the word Vinaya has a much wider meaning, and refers in total to all of the rules and regulations and conventions and customs and agreements that we come to in families and communities that support the practice of Dhamma. So the Buddha gave great importance to how we live together in society, and encouraging us to find ways of creating family situations, communities, which help us to grow in the Dhamma and don't inhibit or punish our aspirations. So this is a teaching both of the inside and the outside, and it's personal and it's social. when Buddhism is referred to, often people go straight to teaching of meditation, and by that they mean application of certain techniques in certain special postures and situations. But that is just one aspect of this education. And if meditation practices are not integrated in the whole education of body, speech and mind, of the inner, the outer, of the personal and the social, then their effectiveness will be much diminished and probably at best will become a means of stress reduction. But that would be a shame if such incredibly powerful tools were only used for that purpose. So first let me also add here that one of the key teachings of the Thai forest tradition, and particularly of my teacher, Ajahn Chah, was the inseparability of these three areas of education, of speech and action, of the heart, and of wisdom, and that they are intimately connected. So it's not like a step-by-step progress where you start to become more moral and you keep precepts, and then after you've been keeping precepts for a while and you kind of firmly found it, then you can start to meditate, and then after you've meditated for a while, you can go on to the work of wisdom. So it's not a step-by-step approach in that way. So let me take the training in or training of the action and speech for a moment. And as an aside here, it's probably worth noting that there is no real word in the Pali language used by the Buddha or in the Buddha's discourses which can be translated as meditation. So Buddhism is well known for meditation, but there's not really a word that means meditation in the way that most people use that word these days. But the word that the Buddha used was pavana, which means cultivation. So it's like a spectrum or a whole different topics of cultivation. And meditation is one particular mode of cultivation. So in the cultivation of our actions and speech, we look at human nature. So in many religious traditions, particularly those that believe in like a lawgiver deity, one who lays down the law, lays down commandments, and then initiates a reward and punishment system to support it, saying you keep these rules and you will receive a wonderful reward, usually after you die. If you don't keep these rules, then the rule giver will be very angry and will punish you and maybe punish you eternally. So this is the kind of pattern of moral codes throughout the world. Now, the Buddhist attitude is very different. The Buddhist attitude, we look at human community, and we look at living together, and we look at what makes living together painful and difficult, and what makes living together happy and harmonious. And we look particularly at what are the core or what are the fundamental needs we have as social beings. And the Buddha's answer is, before all else, we need a feeling of safety. That's absolutely unnegotiable. If we have no feeling of safety, you can be receiving the most profound teachings from a fully enlightened being, and you probably won't get much out of them if you're living in a place in which you don't feel safe. So one of the ideas of monasteries, for instance, is to provide a totally safe environment. one of which you are, you can look at things that you maybe don't want to look at very much, and one in which you can open without fearing that you're going to be taken advantage of. But in families, in communities generally, this very same need is absolutely fundamental. It has to be met. So how do we go about doing that in a very practical way? Well, the Buddha takes his observation of human nature, and he points out that we have a certain tool that we can make use of, and that is willpower. Willpower, or the power to refrain from not doing certain things, that is like a wonderful and unique gift that we have as a human being. So, for instance, you see something very attractive, very desirable, and you look around and you realize you could take that thing. It's an iPad or something like that, or some expensive object. There's no cameras, there's no people. You could take it. You have a strong desire to take it, but probably you don't take it. Why? Because perhaps you say, it wouldn't be right, or that person would feel so upset if they came back and their possessions had disappeared. This is a very simple demonstration that although we have certain natural desires and instincts, that we don't always follow them. That under certain circumstances, we override them. And this is the power that we have to stand back from our instincts and desires that the Buddha taught us to use as our tool, our main tool in educating our actions and speech. So if we look at the mind, then we find that willpower doesn't have any real effect. For instance, you might read a spiritual book, listen to a talk, become very inspired, and make a decision. From this day onwards, I'm going to have loving kindness for everyone. I'm going to look on everyone as my fellow human beings, deserving of love and kindness and so on. So you can get very high thinking like this, can't you? It feels good, but you can't do it. You can't make a decision never to get angry anymore, because the causes and conditions of anger do not respond to willpower. But you can through willpower make a decision that even if I get angry, I will not express that anger physically or verbally. And this is how we create a sense of safety in our families and our communities. Through the five precepts, we say to the people around us, look, be frank, I still get angry sometimes. I love you. I really do love you. But every now and again, you really get on my nerves. And sometimes I just want to thump you, you know, and be really frank here. And I get irritated and upset and so on. But I promise you that although every now and again I lose my temper, I get angry, I will never, ever abuse you physically or verbally. So I would say that's a practical standard. That's not too idealistic. It's difficult, but it's doable. And if you make that announcement in family, how do the people around you feel? They feel safe. So you've given them a gift of safety. And this also applies for the other precepts. You say, yeah, I'm still greedy. You know, there's so many things I'd like and I'd enjoy. But I promise you, I will never take anything that doesn't belong to me. I'll never cheat you. Again, you know, you feel a sense of relief. You know, this when lay people look at the life of monks, then often you know, you just see what monks don't have. And the things that monks have, which are so valuable, are not visible. But one of the things we have is like, even if you know monks don't have such expensive items, but even if I had something that was very expensive, I know I could leave it here, and I'd be absolutely sure that tomorrow morning it would still be here, the day after tomorrow it would still be here, a month today. Nobody would ever take anything that doesn't belong to them. And that's just such a wonderful feeling to have. And as monks living with in the monastic community of very high moral standards, there's this real wonderful sense of well-being, which, as I say, is from the outside, you can't see that so much, because it's not that we have things, but it's through this shared integrity, a sense of safety that we all have. So in lay life, again, the third precept, you know, is the cause of so much stress and jealousy and bad feeling. Then the someone who's married or is in a stable relationship says, "Look, I confess." Every now and again, if it's a man, says to his wife or his girlfriend, "I see other women, I'm attracted to them. I find them beautiful." It's just natural. I'm a young man, or I'm a unenlightened human being. These sexual impulses are still present within me. But I promise that even if I do have these feelings arising regarding another woman, I will never act upon them. I will never speak. I will never communicate those feelings to another woman. So in a relationship, then that makes you, that's a relief, isn't it? You don't have to worry. You don't have to be suspicious. You don't have to have these irrational, jealous feelings arising. So you trust. So when you take these precepts, you create a sense of safety and a sense of trust, mutual respect. Similarly with the precept about not lying or misrepresenting the truth under any circumstances. You know, we talk about three areas, like public area, private area, and secret area. So telling the truth doesn't mean that you can't have private matters that you don't want to talk about with others, but don't have secret matters, because those are the ones that really undermine relationships. Now the last precept is the most important, because your ability to live up to that promise of never acting upon aggressive feelings or lustful feelings or acquisitive feelings and so on cannot be sustained fully if you are taking alcohol or drugs. And if your promise and if your commitment to creating and giving this gift of harmlessness and trust to others is dependent on, it can only be taken seriously at those times when you don't take drink or drugs and they disappear as soon as you do, then the whole thing falls apart. So to sustain this sense of safety, we abstain from all substances that undermine or weaken our sense of responsibility and our sense of right and wrong, and our and our sense restraint. Now, talking this way, like, so with precepts, you can see that I think that it's only when you really see clearly with wisdom the value of each precept that you'll be able to keep it. But even if you do see the value, then you also need the development and the cultivation of the heart to support it. In particular, development of mindfulness, development of patience, patient endurance, and development of loving kindness. These are aspects of the cultivation of the heart, which are very supportive of the cultivation of action and speech. And one other area in which wisdom comes into play is that the Buddha said that if you keep precepts, you keep, you're very full of integrity in your daily life and your relations to others, but on account of that morality, on account of that those precepts, you consider yourself superior to people who don't keep precepts, then your sila or your virtue is damaged. It's impure. So if we're going to use these words, impure, kind of loaded words, but the Buddha is saying that keeping all five precepts without flaw doesn't mean that your sila is pure. Because if you're keeping those precepts with some gaining idea or with reference to those precepts, you start feeling puffed up and feeling special and feeling more virtuous than other people, then your precepts themselves become impure. So there are, to keep precepts is in the way advocated by the Buddha, need a lot of other qualities of the heart and qualities of wisdom. Now, in the cultivation of the heart, excuse me, of which meditation practices form a prominent feature, we can say that, in summary, what we're trying to do is to learn how to deal effectively with unwholesome dhammas and how to effectively cultivate positive dhammas. So here, positive, negative, meaning kusala, akusala, bun, bap, so many different ways of talking about it. So regarding negative mental states, whether they're greed, anger, selfishness, jealousy, depression, anxiety, etc., etc., one of the first life skills that we need to cultivate is how to protect our mind so that those negative mental states cannot enter into the mind. So that's the first area of study. Second area is, in those cases where we're unsuccessful and negative mental states have already entered into our mind, we need strategies and techniques and methods, ability to let go of them, to abandon them. So our education here, firstly, how to protect the mind against negative mental states. Secondly, how to deal with negative mental states that have already arisen. Then regarding positive mental states, whether they're things like mindfulness, clear comprehension, loving kindness, peace, tranquility, contentment, etc., etc., then we have to have strategy. We have to be intelligent in finding ways to bring those qualities into the mind. And fourthly, when we have brought these qualities into mind, they're still quite weak, like young shoots, green shoots in the mind. Then we also have to develop the ability to take care of them, to feed them, to nourish them, and to bring them to maturity. So this is the four right efforts, the four main efforts that we're making in the cultivation of the heart. Two referring to negative mental states, and two referring to positive mental states. Learning how to protect against unarisen negative mental states, learning how to reduce and eliminate already arisen negative mental states, how to produce positive mental states, and how to cultivate and to nourish positive mental states until they reach maturity. So here we can start now talking about meditation. So meditation practices are this cultivation of the heart in a formal setting. So the cultivation of the heart should take place throughout the day. Indeed, it must take place throughout the day. But our ability to cultivate the heart in our daily life with all of its confusion and pressures and temptations is largely dependent upon the time and effort that we put into the cultivation of the heart in the formal meditation sessions. So these two things condition each other. If you're putting effort into cultivating your heart during the day, when you come to meditate in the formal way of sitting and walking, you find that your mind is ready. There's very little resistance, and there's very little kind of cleaning of inner junk from the mind before you can enter into the meditation. And similarly, as I mentioned just now, if you've been doing the formal meditation regularly, then there's a certain momentum and a power of mindfulness and awareness that will be a refuge to you and which you can draw upon during the daily life. Now, these four efforts in the formal meditation sessions begin with us choosing a meditation object, for instance, the breath. And our first goal, first challenge, is to find a way of being with the breath such that unarisen negative mental states do not arise. And of the negative mental states, there are five in particular which tend to arise and are provoked by meditation. We call them the five hindrances. So trying to prevent any of the five hindrances from entering into the mind. But on those occasions where we are not successful and hindrances have entered the mind, then we need to apply effort to let go of them. The positive mental states that we are trying to develop, initially there are three mental states. One is mindfulness, which means bearing in mind your task and your responsibilities, and not forgetting the information that you have as how to proceed, remembering the instructions, holding the meditation object in mind, not forgetting. This is closely associated with a second positive mental state called sampajanya, or clear comprehension. And this is the wisdom representative. It's this knowing the mind, being present. For instance, mindfulness needs to be not too tight, not too loose. And sampajanya is sort of like quality control. It monitors the work of mindfulness to make sure that the mindfulness is not too tight, not too loose. Or if you lose your mindfulness and you start get lost in a daydream, for instance, then the recognition that, oh, I'm daydreaming, oh, this is foolish thought, that's the sampajanya. It's the awareness of what's going on. And then the mind returns to the meditation object using this third mental quality of atapi, or right effort. So these are the initial positive mental states which are being developed in the meditation. And then when they arise, we tend to look after them, to nourish them, and then more and more wholesome dhammas, particularly what we call the bojangas, or enlightenment factors, begin to appear. So cultivation of the heart, focused on dealing wisely with unwholesome and wholesome mental states. Meditation is a very focused part of that cultivation, one in which we cut off most of our the external sense world. We sit in a particular posture which is conducive to the practice. We close our eyes, and we're able to put our whole effort and interest into this cultivation. So there's a lot more that I could say, obviously, about the relationship between the different kinds of cultivation. I haven't really spoken very much at all about wisdom cultivation here. But I think that for now, for this morning, this will suffice. Now we will have a meditation period for 30 minutes.